You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
As I told Mayor Rawlings, I believe that I speak for every single American when I say that we are horrified over these events and that we stand united with the people and the police department in Dallas.
President Barack Obama responds yet again to yet another horrendous gun crime. 5 Dallas police officers killed and 7 more wounded. My guests Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the ongoing wait for someone to take charge of Great Britain and... The 2016 trophy will be hoisted by France or Portugal, but are Wales and Iceland the real winners? That's all coming up on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today from Monocle's editorial floor are Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. Welcome both. And we will start in Dallas, where 5 police officers have been killed and 7 more wounded by what appears to have been a sniper attack. At least one gunman opened fire on officers supervising a protest against recent police shootings of black people. Here's Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings addressing media a few hours ago.
To say that our police officers put their life on the line every day is no hyperbole, ladies and gentlemen. It's a reality. We as a city, we as a country, must come together, lock arms, and heal the wounds that we all feel from time to time.
That's Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings reacting to shootings earlier today of 5 Dallas police officers. 3 people are in custody. One other suspect, named as a 25-year-old former U.S. Army reservist, Micah Johnson, was killed by a robot-delivered explosive after a standoff with police. He is reported to have said that he wanted to kill white people. Steve, first of all, it seems like just when we think that we have reported on and discussed the American gun crime, which has boggled our imagination beyond any degree to which it could be boggled any further, they managed to come up with something even worse or even more bizarre or grotesque.
Indeed, there are many things to unpack here. First, there were the incidents earlier this week of 2 black men in separate incidents being killed by white police, where all the evidence seen so far, and obviously lots of this was seen, was on video, suggests that these people were killed for no good reason. The most recent one was the 123rd black person killed by a police officer so far this year. If you are black and live in America, you will be scared of police officers. That is undeniable. And the problem, the broader problem here is that when none of these police officers, or very, very few of these police officers, face any disciplinary proceedings, let alone are put on trial for murder, as many of these cases should be, then people get angry. And in a country where everyone who wants a gun, pretty much, can have one, where in states like Texas, you can even carry them openly, and we'll get onto that as well later on, you are going to have a situation where when someone is angry and they have a gun, they can do something about it. And this is a very, very dark period for America. And the biggest problem about it is that I cannot see how the situation improves.
Well, this is always the difficulty, because even if America was to come to what I think we would regard as its senses tomorrow and pass the kind of laws against especially automatic weapons which obtain everywhere else in the civilized world, there are so many of them still already in circulation that it would make very little difference. Tom, of the many bizarrenesses of this event, one was, of course, a subplot that quite early on the Dallas police sent out a photograph of a suspect they were trying to apprehend. And in any other circumstance, he would have seemed, frankly, like a reasonable pick. He was wearing camouflage-patterned clothing and carrying an assault weapon. Anywhere else in the world, you would think, yep, you would reasonably want a word with that guy. It turns out that, of course, in Texas, he's doing absolutely nothing wrong. And indeed, he proved to be an altogether blameless citizen.
Absolutely. And that picks up, I think, on one of the absurdities here, which Steve was alluding to, which is that there's no wrongdoing in behaving that way, which would seem out of order across the pretty much, I think, the entire developed world. One thing, Andrew, which struck me as particularly...
Even most of the undeveloped world, to be honest.
There's one thing that struck me as particularly poignant and depressing, actually, about what Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings had to say was he called plaintively and in a broken voice for unity. The problem with this, and you mentioned it in your introduction, that each time these terrible things happen, whether it's Sandy Hook or what we saw in Florida or now this incident, you hope that it might bring people together. There could be a unifying moment. But in fact, the opposite is true. And ridiculously, ludicrously, when these events continue to unfold, it seems to have the opposite effect. It seems that, if anything, increase the polarisation, and it galvanises people into positions that they hold.
Famously, sales of guns always spike after an event like this.
You can imagine the same thing happening now.
Indeed, both because people are more frightened of crime, and they are also more frightened, ironically enough, that laws will finally be passed to stop them buying guns.
But doesn't it come down then to a more fundamental question, which is, and these statistics are often bandied around, I think sometimes unhelpfully, Canada has more guns per capita, but you don't see this sort of thing happening every day. The Swiss have plenty of guns, and yet they seem to get through days without slaughtering one another. But is that the question we need to ask? Is there something profoundly unstable about your average American? I think any right-minded person would know that that's not the case. I've got to be honest. I feel despairing about it, and I cannot foresee any meaningful change on this. And it's not even in terms of in the next electoral cycle or two. I can't see anything happening for generations.
This shooting now in Dallas of police officers makes an already horrendous situation far more complex and far more potentially dangerous, because we are reaching a situation where you have a large portion of the population does not trust the police.
Indeed not.
But now you have, on top of that, you're going to have a large portion of the police that is going to become scared of the public.
Well, this is a question that that does occur to me at moments. Those incidents you mentioned earlier this week, those two, as far as it's possible to tell, entirely blameless black citizens fatally shot by police. Clearly, there is an issue of race, because black people are shot by police far out of proportion to their prevalence in the general population. But I do wonder occasionally, and with all due recognition of the fact that we are three white guys sitting in a studio in London discussing this, whether there is a gun issue as well as a race issue, that police are more inclined to open fire because they're having to factor in the possibility that they're dealing with somebody who is also armed.
There is. And that's why it's complex. It's not one thing or another. This can be many things all at the same time. But the race issue is actually crucial here, because as we saw in Ferguson, Missouri, and I haven't had a chance to look at the breakdown of who's who in the police forces in any of the places which have in the past week have had these fatalities. But as we saw in Ferguson, Missouri, you had a overwhelmingly white police force that was policing an overwhelmingly black area. And that was not unusual. And you see this, in many different parts of the world. Here in the UK, in London, it's got a lot better in the last 15 years after the McPherson report, which was an inquiry into the killing of Stephen Lawrence, a black man who was killed by four white racist thugs who all got away with it. And that inquiry revealed that there was what became known as institutional racism inside the police force. And one of the things that they said we need to sort out is the fact that this police force does not represent the community it serves. Mm. And when you have that situation, as you have in so many American towns and cities, where you have overwhelmingly white police forces that are policing majority black or even large minority black communities, you are going to have this problem.
Except, though, as you're pointing out, that it is complex and multi-layered, because it's not like this problem only exists in communities like the one you've described.
There are lots of different things indeed, on top of each other. So just go on to this point. I think part of the problem of this debate has often been, for me, I think it's gun control, so I'm just going to talk about gun control. Mm-hmm. And for someone else, it's like, oh, well, for me, it's, it's this. And, there are lots of different things going on here, and we should be able to deal with them all.
But is it any wonder that perhaps some of the nuances of this are lost? If you look at the sort of general state of political rhetoric in the US, and I'm by no means, being in a glass house throwing stones, and we'll come on to this in the programme.
We shall.
We're in an equally problematic time in this country, and I'm talking politely. But it's not that surprising that some of the nuance is lost when you consider the general level of the rhetoric involved here.
Well, on that subject, I wanted to ask you both not just about the political rhetoric, but also about the media rhetoric. How potentially dangerous can the media be at a moment like this in terms of the tone they take? I mean, the New York Post, which is never known for its restraint, has run with the headline Civil War. It's one that just is basically factually inaccurate. And two, it does seem kind of hard to see how that helps.
Well, indeed. And also, you'd think a country which actually had a civil war, reporters in that, or editors in that country would understand the difference. Yes, there is a responsibility on journalists to tell the story in a proper way, to, for example, not release photos of someone who is supposedly a suspect who actually isn't at all. There's responsibilities for online media organisations to not try and finger the wrong person. And, we also have, let's say this guy's written a manifesto and it turns up online in the next hour or so.
Which wouldn't be that surprising.
People will print it.
Yeah.
Now, if you know that your manifesto, and I use the term loosely, is going to be published, isn't that then also an encouragement? I will do this and the world will see my anger, my views, which aren't, because I'm not being listened to. I'm not being listened to. People will listen to me if I do this.
Except the trouble is now that it doesn't really matter whether the actual media print the manifesto or not anymore. The media used to be in a position to exercise that judgment.
There's a broader point about regulation, and you talk about real-time coverage of these sorts of instances on social media and so forth. Listen, I wish I had an answer for how you could police that kind of platform. But I think Steve's right in the sense that the traditional media, if we use that term fairly loosely, can certainly lead the way. And I think that there's been some cravenly irresponsible coverage. And I think that Civil War headline is astonishing in its sort of arrogance and its ignorance and in how inappropriate it is.
I just want to touch finally on the likely political ramifications of this. To the considerable surprise of many, Donald Trump's statement on the subject was punctiliously non-inflammatory, actually quite reflective and mature, and almost like the kind of thing you would expect a grown-up politician to say. Do we assume that he stopped writing his own material?
In this case, possibly, but
it's not necessarily the week to hail his
not intended to be heard as an endorsement. I'm not sitting here thinking, I'm looking at him in a whole different light.
I dread to think what his next rally is going to be like and the sort of thoughts he will pluck from the ether.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. Coming up next, an almost certainly doomed attempt to make any sense of the weirdest week in British politics since last week.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Singapore, our bureau chief is Nolan Giles.
I think for Monocle, the news that we're after isn't your ordinary what's big on Channel News Asia kind of news. It's the stories that are a little bit harder to find, the stories that you have to dig a little bit deeper. And the way that the team operates here from the Singapore Bureau is we're often dispatched to different countries in the region, to different cities, to travel, to explore, to meet people, to be on the ground and be in the action and build a strong contact base.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me is Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. Now, it feels a lot longer than 2 weeks and a day ago that British politics were generally stable and orderly, distinguished from the usual run-of-the-mill only by a mildly chaotic opposition and a referendum campaign on EU membership, which, while unpleasant, was assumed to be dwindling towards a resentful acquiescence with the status quo. 2 weeks and a day later, the opposition is in a state of open civil war. The ruling party looks like the closing scene of Hamlet, and it is entirely possible that we are weeks away from 10 Downing Street being inhabited by someone who almost nobody in the country had heard of a month ago. Before we get into it all, here is a brief introduction to both Andrea Leadsom, and an introduction to her is certainly needed, and Theresa May.
It has been a journey. Now, when I came into Parliament, like most people in the country, I'd grown up as part of the EU, and it's absolutely part of our sort of DNA. And I came into Parliament, set up something called the Fresh Start Project, which took hundreds and hundreds of hours of evidence about how the EU impacts on the UK, on everything from immigration to fisheries to budgets and so on. And during that process, I travelled all across Europe with lots of parliamentary colleagues, up to 100 of Conservative colleagues supporting this work, to try and get a really decent fundamental reform of the EU.
Good afternoon. I'm delighted to have won so much support from my colleagues. I've won votes from Conservative MPs from across the party, from left and right, Leavers and Remainers, MPs from the length and breadth of the country. This vote shows that the Conservative Party can come together, and that under my leadership it will. Now, I've always said there should be a proper contest. Now is the time for me and my team to take my case out to the party members in the country.
The two contenders there, the last we heard was the Home Secretary, Theresa May. Before that, somebody called Andrea Leadsom. First of all, Steve, Tom, be honest, a month ago, would you have known Andrea Leadsom if she'd sat down next to you on the tube?
Steve, you can field that one.
No, genuinely.
No,
genuinely. And you know, I'm pretty geeky when it comes to British politics. I was familiar with the name, but couldn't necessarily I certainly wouldn't recognise her. The reason I was familiar with the name is because a rather good magazine here in the UK called Private Eye had been running a series of stories about her dodgy offshore tax dealings. But no, I mean, if she literally sat down next to me and said, "Hello, I'm an MP," I would be like, okay.
I tend to only...
are we sure she actually is?
I tend to only sit up and take notice of MPs if they've had a bit of a stint. As said, she's only came into Parliament in 2010. Andrew, before we came on air, you mentioned a nice little nugget of information about if she were to become Prime Minister, the relative brevity of her time before taking the appointment.
I think I'm right in saying she would be the first British Prime Minister since Balfour, who was obviously a long time ago, who has not previously been Leader of the Opposition or Home or Foreign Secretary or Chancellor of the Exchequer. She is extraordinarily inexperienced to take over what is, you know, a fairly complicated and difficult job.
Not only is she inexperienced, but she's also more inexperienced than her CV suggests.
She was the first woman on Mars, though,
yes,
doesn't it?
People have had a lot of fun with her CV over the past few days, because it turns out that she embellished a few things here and there over the course of time. Look, I mean, my bigger concern, aside from the fact that no one knows who she is and she lied on her CV, is that she is deeply unimpressive. She's talked about bringing back fox hunting. She's talked about how the fact she doesn't like the gay marriage legislation. She is a old school right winger in the mold of old school right wingers like Ian Duncan Smith and John Redwood, who were the sort of can I say batshit crazy?
I think you can.
You just have.
There we are.
Is this not the progressive politics that I've been keep reading about?
Yeah. So look, the big thing as well here is that we've just had a big referendum on the future of Britain. We've talked about how important it is that Britain is a democracy and how everyone should have a say in how they are run. And 33 million people voted in that referendum. 150,000 people get a vote as to who our new Prime Minister will be. And they are over the average age is well over 60. The average political view is somewhere to the right of Genghis Khan. The average social view is, well, I'll tolerate a gay person, perhaps. And yet these people are going to be choosing who runs Britain.
I was going to actually jump in there, Andrew, and say that it's exactly that point. We're seeing a clear crisis on the left in this country because you've got a party that's gripped by internal divisions and a sort of a disconnect between the political party, i.e. the parliamentary
Labour Party you're talking about
and its voting constituents out in the grassroots. And exactly the same dynamic one senses exists on the right of the political spectrum. And my worry is, particularly given that ongoing crisis on the left, it's grist in the mill. It makes it easier, potentially, for grassroots Conservative Party members to make to take more of a gamble. And I think, Steve summed up pretty accurately the problems with Andrea Leadsom. It's perfectly plausible that she could win a vote amongst members of the party, and that is a deeply frightening idea.
I mean, is it your sense, and this is where I'm going to ask the pair of you to speak on behalf of all 60 million of your compatriots, that what we're going through now in terms of British politics is a sort of a brief, if somewhat extreme, period of turbulence after which everything will return to its usual cruising altitude? Or actually, I'm not really sure where this metaphor is going, but you know what I'm saying. Is something quite strange and profound occurring, or is this just a bit of a wobble?
Well, if we're talking about a plane, I guess let's not continue with the metaphor, that's why I
sort of abandoned that.
So look, one thing that has passed now very swiftly in the last 3 weeks, which is astonishing, which is the Notting Hill set, the smooth modernisers of the Conservative Party, David Cameron, George Osborne, Michael Gove, and Boris Johnson, who all went to the same university. Three of them were in the Bullingdon Club, where you drink till you throw up and then you smash in the window of the restaurant. They all went to the same dinner parties. They literally do go to the same dinner parties, even now.
Not anymore, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, okay, not until recently. But Michael Gove is the godfather of David Cameron's kids.
Again, I'm not sure. Can that status be revoked?
I'm not sure that kid's going to get many presents from his godfather anytime soon. But anyway, that whole generation that essentially dominated not just Conservative politics, but British politics for the last 10 years, has gone. They're going to be replaced probably by Theresa May, a more sort of old school, more patrician sort of prime minister. On the left, we've got this huge, again, you had this modernising force in the 90s and early 2000s called New Labour, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, and we've seen as well this week with, the epitaph for Tony Blair and his time in power. They've been replaced by these sort of old style left wing insurgents. So yeah, it is all slightly up in the air, and no one really knows what's going to happen next. And of course, let's face it, these might be the two main parties, but there is UKIP still there, waiting in the wings, particularly if Labour don't get their house in order.
Well, we should move along because we'll have plenty of, I suspect, opportunities to discuss Britain's political roilings in coming weeks, months, hopefully not years. But finally tonight, it is still a little over 48 hours until the 2016 European Championship final, which will pit France against Cristiano Ronaldo and 10 members of the Portuguese public. Two teams, however, have started celebrating already. Defeated semi-finalists Wales have been granted the full-scale open-top bus conquering heroes return in Cardiff, and defeated quarter-finalists Iceland were welcomed home to Reykjavik by more or less the entire national population. Before we proceed, however, a reminder of the contribution Icelandic fans have made to the lexicon of footballing crowd exclamations. The Icelandic fans there, a chant subsequently adopted by almost everybody else's fans at Euro 2016.
And people in the Monocle office as well.
And people in the Monocle office. And long may it continue. I like that one. But what I did want to talk about was whether a run like this for a hitherto unfancied national team like Wales or Iceland, does it reflect beyond football? Is this what we would think of at Monocle as a triumph of soft power?
I think definitely, without any question. You only have to look at... I mean, I must be honest. When I watched Wales' triumphalist homecoming earlier, I did feel slightly conflicted
about
it.
Come on, Tom, they came fourth.
tied third, optimistically.
Could you remind us how England got on, would you?
Well, no, and this is a fair point. I'm not the biggest fan of England as a footballing entity, as you may or may not know. That aside, it was incredible. And you saw a galvanising effect on a country. You saw a great deal of... what can I call it? Positive statements of national pride and national sentiment, unlike the sort of jingoistic, unpleasant, meanderings that we've had to deal with in the aftermath of Brexit and so forth. And for Iceland, likewise, a tiny, tiny country, a few hundred thousand people, punching well above their weight. And I think it's an exact embodiment of what soft power, or whatever you want to call it, can do for a country. Proper, good old-fashioned positive branding, Andrew.
I mean, Steve, in terms of the positive branding, as well as the football team sort of playing well and doing well and getting the country attention, how important is the fans' contribution? Because the Welsh fans clearly made a lot of friends everywhere they went in France, as did the Icelandic fans.
Oh, huge, huge. And, it's not just about, what happens on the pitch. It's about the fans. Because if, let's face it, England had won the Euros.
No, but
indeed,
really.
Yeah. But our fans had behaved as our fans do, making good use of French police tear gas and so on. That wouldn't make you think any better of England.
No, it wouldn't.
Would it? So the fact that there were 30,000 Icelandic fans in France, one-tenth of the entire population of the nation was there, and that they were had a great time, were wonderfully behaved, and had that amazing chant, that then tells you something about the nation. More than just, how the 11 people played on the pitch. This is obviously, a nation of good, nice, happy, interesting people.
And the president got involved as well.
Exactly.
It was in the stands. That's the kind of thing that plays well domestically, but it plays well internationally.
Let me mention Ireland here as well, because their fans, have a similar reputation for being sort of, good fans on the road. And there were all these cases. It was particularly good because it was at the same time as England were like throwing plastic chairs, where of cases of them, they helped an elderly couple change a tyre. That was good. They sang songs about how much they love the French police. You saw them...
To the considerable bewilderment of the French police, who initially looked like they were about to start tear gassing.
Get
them.
The tear gas out, guys. They were also, lots of great scenes of them singing with Swedish fans. Again, that makes you think, Ireland is a good place. Ireland is the sort of place I want to go. If, an Irish guy moves in next to me, I'll be like, oh, that's quite cool. These are the things that matter, I think, more than what happens on the pitch.
I'd like to add one final thing. I think it should be like Eurovision. We should invite the Australians to take part, because one thing's become painfully apparent over the last 12 months. England can't beat anyone except Australia. Choose your sport, Andrew.
I will choose our sport. I'm going to choose Australian rules football, at which I quite fancy our chances. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thank you, Tom Edwards.
I think we could beat you at Aussie rules football.
Really? Is that really what you think, Steve?
Yeah. I mean, you know.
You told me it's a sport. Basically, it's a legalized punch-up.
Well, you fellas set it up, and we'll see how that goes. Your best 21 against our best 21. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Hannah Ritchie, and Barclay Brown. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. More music next at 1900 hours. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie, and there's The Cinema Show at 2000. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.